Welcome, everybody. Today, we are very happy to have Baur Mukametzano from IAS, and he will talk about generalized DTH, JT with matter, and random matrices. Please keep your microphone muted and only unmute if you want to ask questions. Baur, the stage is yours.
All right. So, well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak. It's great to be virtually with you. So today I'm gonna tell you about some work in progress with Daniel Jeffries, David Kolchmeier, and Julian Sonner, which will hopefully appear in not too distant future. Roughly, the plan of the talk is that we will first review some aspects of random matrices, and two aspects of that. So one is the original sort of application for energy level statistics of chaotic Hamiltonians. Another aspect is something that was developed in the 80s in application to two-dimensional theories of quantum gravity, and that sometimes they can actually be the same via holography. And then we'll generalize this to include other operators besides the Hamiltonian, and talk about eigenstate thermalization hypothesis and how to think of it as a matrix model. And then we will focus on a particular example, first of all, on holographic theories, and second, more specifically, on JT gravity coupled to matter. And then we will conclude. So that's roughly the plan. So just sort of not to keep you in suspense, let me spill the beans, so to speak, right away. And just a short summary so that you have a rough idea of what we would like to do. First of all, in a few years ago, Saab, Schenker, and Stanford showed that JT gravity is equivalent to a random matrix model. This matrix has two interpretations in that model. So one interpretation is that it's a random Hamiltonian of the dual quantum mechanics. And the second interpretation is more geometric, and is that you can think of two diagrams of that matrix model as building two-dimensional surfaces via triangulations. Is that literally the two diagrams, or the dual lattice that builds triangulations of the two-dimensional surface, and therefore describes fluctuating geometry? Today we will generalize this picture to include matter fields in the bulk. We will specifically talk about adding just free scalars. Similarly to the pure JT case, this scalar or the dual operator O will have two different meanings. So one is that we can think of it as a random operator in the quantum mechanical model. And so therefore it's on a similar footing with the random Hamiltonian. So this is sort of generalized eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. Second is that it will also have a geometric meaning, just like the Hamiltonian, that two diagrams of this operator O in the matrix model, they will have a geometric interpretation of a particle propagating on geodesics of a two-dimensional surface that was created by the Hamiltonian. Finally, we would like to sort of generalize this picture and conjecture that holographic theories in two dimensions, at least in general, will have some kind of multi-matrix model description, where you have a Hamiltonian which sort of builds the fluctuating surfaces for you. And then in addition, for every single trace operator, you add a random matrix to your matrix model. So I should emphasize here that single trace operator here means really in the gauge theory sense, not in the matrix model sense. So here in the matrix model, it's more like the trace. These traces in the matrix model is more like Hilbert space traces. And when I say single trace operators here, I mean more like gauge theory sense. And then the multi-twist operators will be built out of products of these more primitive single trace operators. We will find that at large C, this matrix model will not be Gaussian in O, but it will have some kind of integrability structure that we could still say something. And the fact that the potential in the matrix model is single trace is intimately related to bulk locality, to the fact that interactions in the bulk are local. So that's sort of my short one slide summary. Please stop me at any point for any questions or clarifications. Okay, so essentially that's kind of the roadmap. Now we will just go ahead and start with some review of classic applications of random matrices. So one sort of Wignerian, another Tuft-like. And so random matrices in physics were introduced by Wigner to describe energy level statistics of chaotic Hamiltonians and subsequently studied by many people. So if we consider a chaotic Hamiltonian and pick some microcanonical band, then you can think of the Hamiltonian as essentially a random matrix of size e to the s by e to the s. Assuming that the Hamiltonian is sufficiently chaotic, this spectrum is dense, and so all these sort of usual assumptions, which are not typically sort of, there's no sharp definition of chaotic, but typically we can recognize these systems by certain properties like dense spectrum, sensitivity to inertial conditions, known integrals of motion, and so on. So that's sort of one classic application. So the second sort of famous application of random matrices is that in the 80s, random matrices were used to construct quantum gravity in two dimensions by this gentleman and then many others after them. So here, the idea is roughly as follows. Let's consider a matrix integral. Let's say just with the cubic interaction, but we can also include any higher order interactions. Then in the perturbative expansion at large n or in the genus expansion, all we need to do is compute two diagrams. So for example, these double lines on the picture here. Then if we draw a dual lattice to this Tuft diagram, this can be thought of as some triangulation of a two-dimensional surface. So in particular, because we chose the interaction here to be cubic, the faces are triangles. For higher order interactions, we can have squares, pentagons, and so on. The parameters of this matrix model, such as this coupling constant G here, they can be tuned such that diagrams of large order or with many faces will dominate, effectively taking the size of the triangulation to zero and therefore describing some kind of smooth surfaces where triangulation size is going to zero. And so in this way, in the 80s, people found how to describe the so-called minimal strings, which is Liouville gravity coupled to minimal models. And in a way, this realized the old idea of Tucht with the, about the large unlimited in a precise way. More recently, in 2019, Saad, Schenker, and Stanford showed that, in fact, these two applications that I just described, they can actually be equivalent through holography, through IDS CFT. And the model where this turned out to be true is the so-called Jakif Teitelbaum gravity and JT gravity in two dimensions. So the I'll just give a very short sort of review of this theory. So the action is the just the Euler character of the surface plus plus these other two terms, which include the dilaton and the metric. And so integrating out the dilaton, for example, just localizes you onto surfaces of a constant negative curvature. And so the most interesting part about this theory is that you need to sum over different topologies. And Saad, Schenker, and Stanford showed that JT gravity, if you have boundaries of lengths beta 1 through beta n, is equivalent to a matrix integral where we have one matrix and we have to insert traces of e to the minus beta h, which you can think of as creating boundaries, and h is the Hamiltonian. And in fact, this duality can be thought of as a certain limit of that older duality for minimal strings. So for example, if we compute just one, if we have just one boundary, then we will have a disk, we'll have genus one, genus two, and so on. And they show that this equivalence works perturbatively in the genus expansion. Okay. And so again, on the one hand side, H is the random Hamiltonian, but on the other hand side, because this is a certain limit of the duality for minimal strings, it can also be thought of as arising from this picture with the triangulations. So that was my short review of JT gravity. And now we would like to generalize this, and we would like to discuss what happens when we add some operators. And this is essentially what is called, what is known as eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So let me briefly just describe that. So eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is essentially taking the idea of Wigner to sort of the next level, or it's a next logical step. It says that if you have some light operator O, then its matrix elements in energy eigenstates are essentially random. That it's essentially a random matrix. So it was first introduced in the early 90s by Deutsch, Rednicki, and then it seemed like it was successfully forgotten for over 10 years until people started doing some some numerics and saw that it actually makes sense. And so the ansatz is the following, is that if we take this operator in energy eigenstates, then there is a diagonal piece, which is essentially the thermal expectation value. At the energy E bar, E average, which is and as, or associated temperature with this energy. But then in addition to this diagonal piece, there are off diagonal elements, but they are all exponentially suppressed in the entropy. There is some smooth profile, which depends on the average energy and the energy difference of En and Em. And there's a pseudo-random matrix RNM, which here is normalized to be such that it has a variance one. Okay, so this is sort of this, the way people usually state ETH. And this smooth function F, it's really non-trivial only in some finite band of order the temperature. So in particular, if we consider Lorentzian time evolution, then at very, very long times, only small energy differences will be important. And effectively, this function F is constant. And then that's why at long times, the random matrix theory has, gives universal predictions. But at finite times, the structure of F is important and it's not universal, and it really depends on the system that that you have at hand. And so really, ETH ansatz, it's designed to describe the two-point function. So if we have some two-point function, then in, well here, let's say in some micro-canonical ensemble, then we can insert a full set of energy eigenstates. So there's some overall normalization by the inverse partition function. And then using the ansatz, we get some expression of this sort. And then if we substitute R squared by its average, then we see that this function F is essentially the Fourier transform of the Lorentzian two-point function. However, so usually in this way in which it's usually presented, that matrix R is Gaussian, well, of course, that's not exactly true. Nobody said there can be higher order terms, and they are, of course, there. And so, for example, if you wanted to describe four-point functions and higher-point functions, you essentially it is essential that we include non-Gaussianities in the matrix R. So, for example, if you wanted to describe something like OTOC correlators and discuss scrambling and so on, then you would really need to include these non-Gaussianities, as we will do. So we would like to take the CTH ansatz very seriously and in fact promote it to a full-fledged matrix model to sort of make this sharper because well, such that we can have a sort of more rigorous formulation. So for example, the Gaussian ETH that we described on the previous slide, we just say, okay, we have a two matrix model. So matrix H, this potential for the matrix H will just create the spectral density in your theory. And then we add the Gaussian piece, which essentially describes the ansatz on the previous slide. It's such that the variance is exactly what I wrote on the previous slide. And in general, you can generalize this to include non-Gaussianities. You can think that you can write more complicated potential for the matrix O, where O would be any simple or few-body operator. So this could be a general story, but today we will focus on holographic systems at large C. And so in a holographic system, we will take O to be a single trace operator. Again, here by single trace, I mean not in the matrix model sense, but in sort of gauge theory sense. That there's like, well, you can call it single twist versus multi-twist. And then we'll imagine that multi-twist operators will just be constructed out of products of matrix O and matrix H. We're here, we're on the right-hand side, I really think of just matrices on the Hilbert space. To describe holographic systems, we start with just mean field theory or generalized free fields. And there we immediately see that actually just the Gaussian model is not good. It has problems. In particular, there are two problems which I'll describe now. So one is that if you have a mean field theory correlator, then you compute it by essentially doing weak contractions. And for example, if you compute the four-point function, well, here I did it for finite temperature, but also at zero temperature. But then there are three weak contractions that you have. There's ST and U channels. On the other hand, if we think of the matrix O, if we think of the operator O as a matrix, as writing some matrix model, and let's assume that O was Gaussian, but then in the planar limit, we would find only two diagrams of this type, right? Because the third diagram, which is would be analogous to this diagram, it would not be planar. It would be suppressed in 1/n. So immediately we see that the Gaussian problem would not be enough. In particular, things like OTOC would vanish. Another obstruction for the Gaussian ETH is that in the mean field theory, there are also non-trivial constraints between operators. If you compute the commutator of an operator O at times zero and T, or if you wanted to write it in terms of matrices H and O, so it would be some object like this. But we know that in mean field theory or in generalized free fields, this object is proportional to identity operator times some function of T, right? So if we made H and O to be some matrices, then generically two matrices H and O would never obey such a constraint. Definitely not in the Gaussian O theory, right? And so somehow we need to input that in the matrix model. It turns out that in the matrix model that we'll describe, this constraint is enforced by essentially adding this constraint squared with a large coefficient in the potential of the matrix model. So essentially what happens is that you take this left-hand side minus right-hand side squared and you add that to the potential with a large coefficient. In fact, you tune that coefficient to infinity in the limit that it describes, in the limit that it will describe our holographic system. Okay, so hopefully I will convince you that so Gaussian ETH would not do. I would like to eventually describe the non-Gaussian matrix model we have, but before that, I guess, yeah, let me just maybe stop for any questions and if there's any. Yeah. Or maybe everybody is lost and I went too quickly or too slowly. I don't know. Well, if there are no more questions, then I will get into the review of JT Gravity with Matter and describe the correlators or like the sort of the data that we would like to reproduce in a matrix model. So this will again be some short review. So to make more progress towards this matrix model, we would like to focus on JT gravity coupled to just a free massive scalar, so a very simple model. So of course the dual operator has a dimension delta, given by the standard formula. So the JT gravity part, it's sort of described in the usual way, as was done by Sach, Schenker, and Stanford. And so the effect of the matter is the one loop determinant, and this one loop determinant on the disk, it doesn't do much. It's just it gives an area term to the effective action and effectively renormalizes G Newton. But if you have more boundaries or you have higher genus, then the contribution of the one loop determinant becomes non-trivial, and we will discuss it momentarily. But before we go to higher genus or more boundaries, let me also discuss correlation functions on the disk. So correlation functions of JT coupled to a scalar, or equivalently sort of GFF coupled to Schwarzian, to the Schwarzian mode. So they were derived by in a few different ways by these people and others. Well, there are various ways you can derive it. So for example, Mertens, Turetch, and Verlinde derived it from dimensionally reducing Liouville theory, and Yang, Kitaev, and Su derived it by giving the system a description as a particle in an imaginary magnetic field. And in the end, the result is as follows. So the result is kind of described by just simple, relatively simple Feynman-like rules, right? So they're not quite familiar, because here we really, the effect of the Schwarzian mode is very important, and it's kind of this coupling to gravity to the Schwarzian mode is modifies tensor a lot. But in any case, the sort of algorithm is the following: is that if you want to compute an endpoint function on the disk, so here I'll say four-point function, then what you need to do is to sum over to draw all possible core diagrams, so where you split your operators into pairs and then connect them by lines. Every time you see a juncture of the boundary of the disk and some line coming from the bulk, you assign energies, first of all, to different regions, here E1 and E2. And for each such juncture, you write some factor of gamma functions. So here by plus minus, I mean the product of all possible combinations. So here we have a product of four gamma functions, 2^1/2. The second rule is that if you see a crossing in the bulk of the disk, then you assign four energies to different regions, And for each such crossing, you write this so-called 6J, SL2R 6J symbol, or also known as Wilson function. And it's some special function. It has a horrible definition in terms of some hypergeometric function, but it plays a role in the representation theory of SL2R as a 6J symbol. And because of that, it obeys many nice relations, some of which I will describe later. So just to practice a little bit, so let's compute, for example, the two-point function. Right, so we have 2 points, so there's only one chord diagram we can write. And then we have two junctures of this type. And so we'll just have a product of two factors like this. So this two-point function will be just a gamma function without the power 1/2 here. Okay. And the four-point function then, for the four-point function, we can draw three possible chord diagrams. And this is not a coincidence, actually. It's because it's related to generalized free field. So for generalized free field, there's three weak contractions. And then we just need to dress those with the Schwartz symbols. That's why we get these more complicated answers. So this is in the energy basis. Or if you want to go to Euclidean time, then all you need to do is to take this answers in the energy basis, multiply them by some standard Euclidean time propagation and by the Schwartz and density of states and integrate. So, and this is the full answer. And this is the exact answer in this in JG gravity coupled to a free scalar. And similarly, you can write the answers for the full. Okay, hopefully this was clear. So now if we think of including more boundaries or considering higher genus, so here the one loop determinant from the scalars, from the scalar becomes non-trivial. And it in fact can be computed using this beautiful Selberg trace formula. So because in JT gravity, we localize on just surfaces with negative, with constant negative curvature, we can use this Selberg trace formula for hyperbolic surfaces. And it essentially tells us that we can compute the determinant of the Laplace operator using this formula. So we have an area term with some constant, which again doesn't do much, it just renormalizes G Newton. And then we sum over all a primitive closed geodesics gamma of this Riemann surface. And there's also a sum over N, which you can think of as windings of this geodesics. So the geodesic now can also wind as many times as you want. And delta here is just the conformal dimension associated with the mass. And the gamma is the length of the primitive geodesic. So that's that. And so this is the answer when we have a Riemann surface with fixed moduli or these so that these geodesic lengths are fixed. And then we need to sort of use the gluing procedures to construct the Riemann surface, where in addition we include this factor, which depends on the moduli. And after that, we integrate over moduli to get the full partition function. So it's because of this factor, it modifies somewhat the answers from the pure GT gravity, because the integral over the moduli space of Riemann surfaces is now different. In particular, using this formula for the determinant, if we now also if we now also compute correlators when you have more boundaries or a higher genus, and you include the effect of the one-loop determinant, it turns out that these Feynman rules, which I described on this page, are essentially the same. That if you have non-self-intersecting geodesics, or like non-intersecting geodesics, then you just write these gamma factors for each juncture of the sort. And every time you have an intersection, you would write a 6J simple. And we will see an example of that on the double trumpet a bit later. Okay, so this is the story about JT. Now we would like to actually construct a two-matrix model that would reproduce these answers that I just described, but from a matrix model perspective. Okay, so the goal is to write a two-matrix model for the Hamiltonian and this random operator O. And so the part for the Hamiltonian we would just take to be sort of the Saad-Shenker-Stanford potential that was shown by them to be dual to pure JT gravity. To that, we will add another sort of potential that couples matrices H and O. So how do we determine this potential? So to determine this potential, we use the data of the disk correlators. So there is some sort of, it's sort of equivalent in a sense to know all of the disk correlators or like disk correlators of a product of any number of operators O, and to know the matrix potential. This is somewhat similar to one matrix model where knowing the disk density of states or knowing the potential is essentially two equivalent sets of data. And then given this data, given disk correlators, or equivalently the matrix potential, we would draw conclusions about more boundaries or higher genus. So in the one matrix model case, this was encoded in what was called loop equations, but in two matrix model case, it will be somewhat different. Well, it will be essentially similar in spirit, but details are of course different. So why do I say that these correlators, the core disk correlators that I described, why are they equivalent to saying what matrix potential is? Or why do we even expect that we can do such a computation? So sort of a two matrix, a class of two matrix models that we imagine is that all of the vertices in the matrix model are also constructed out of the structures that are similar to chord diagrams. All of the vertices in this two matrix in this matrix potential for O will be constructed out of either 6J symbols or maybe with some of these gamma factors and delta functions. Okay, so suppose we wrote some complicated matrix potential where all of the vertices are 6J symbols. So for example, let's consider a simple quartic vertex where the interaction is this 6J symbol, right? So the essential reason that this matrix potential would give us a chord diagrams for these correlators is that these 6 J symbols obey a very nice relations, namely unlacing relations and Young-Boxer equations. So in particular, so let's say in this model with just a Gaussian and quartic piece, of course, the two-point function would give you the correct disk two-point function in JT gravity, right? It's just these gamma functions. And then there will, from the Gaussian factor, there will be 2 disconnected pieces in the four-point function, and the connected piece in the four-point function given by this 6 J symbol, right? So, okay, at least at tree level, it's working. But now the real issue comes about when we think about loops in this matrix model. But the claim is that loops actually do not give you new functions of energy. All the loop diagrams will be proportional to the tree-level diagrams. And this is true because 6 J symbol obeys nice identities. So for example, if you computed one loop correction to the two-point function, where this vertex is 6 J symbol of these 4 energies, associated to 4 regions, then 6 J symbol would obey an identity which would tell you it's proportional to just the tree level propagator. Similarly, if we computed one loop correction to the 4-point function, so here again there are 2 6 J symbols, then there is an identity of 6 J symbols, which is so-called orthogonality, which just tells you that it's proportional to a tree-level answer. And in addition, there are things like Young-Boxer that we can move these lines freely up and down. So you can think about these 2 diagrams as kind of like a rope that's goes, it can loop and so on, right? But it connects 2 points, it can loop in between, but you can pull it sort of apart and undo all the loops trivially. And the only role of the loops would be to renormalize overall coefficients. So this is essential reason why we think that this sort of chord matrix potentials and chord discorrelators are equivalent data. So we didn't quite check it in just the strict JT gravity, but we checked it in, well, first of all, because to get JT gravity, you actually need to take some kind of double scaling limit. But we checked it in this so-called Q-deformed JT gravity or Q-deformed SYK. So if you take Q equals to 1, you would get JT gravity. When Q is less than 1, then everything is explicitly finite. It's easier to do computations. And we constructed the potential sort of order by law, order by order at small Q. But hopefully I managed to convey at least the idea why the matrix potential of this type would give you these correlators. For now, we will just sort of take this as a given. And what we will try to do is assume that potential reproducing JT on the disk exists. And then given that data, we will see how matrix model reproduces correlators when you have either more boundaries or higher genus. Well, actually, I'll talk only about more boundaries. That's the idea. Okay. What I will do in the remaining time, I'll just describe a computation of a two-point function on the double trumpet in the matrix model, how the matrix model reproduces the result from JT gravity, given that we know disk correlators. So first of all, let me write down the answer from JT gravity, which I kind of alluded to, but didn't describe in detail. So in JT gravity, the two-point function on the double trumpet, it's computed essentially by this series where you have a contribution where the one loop determinant does not give any contribution. So it's sort of winding zero contribution, if you wish. Then there's a term where you have winding one from that Selberg formula, where we have closed geodesic, primitive geodesic with winding one. Then we have winding two, and so on and so on. And as I said, when you have more boundaries, the Feynman rules, it turns out, still apply. So what we do is we prescribe these two regions different energies, and then we use the Feynman rules. That's where these gamma factors come from these junctures, right? They're slightly different because here the energy on the top and on the bottom are actually the same because they're connected on the other side of the double trumpet or of the cylinder. And then if we have no insertion here, no closed geodesics, then it's just a delta function. So energy on the left and on the right should be the same. Then we have winding one contribution. Essentially, the only new thing is that we have a crossing of two lines. And this crossing, according to the Feynman rules, gives you a 6J symbol. So here, maybe I should sort of like write that here. You can think of associating two energies, E left and E right, to these two regions. And then winding two contribution, so which you derive from Selberg trace formula, you can actually think about it as a contribution of double trace operators. So this winding two is essentially like a double trace operator propagating on that loop in the middle with dimensions to delta plus 2m. And so this is the answer that we got from Selberg trace formula and bulk computation. And now we would like to reproduce it in the matrix model computation. And so winding zero is actually almost trivially reproduced just from the SSS matrix model and discorrelators. So now in the matrix model, if we think about computing this correlator where we have one operator on each side, right? We just expand it into energy eigenstates. And essentially the leading piece would be when we take the expectation values of the densities just in the SSS model. And we also have an expectation value of product of two O's. But this correlator, even though originally we thought of this as a double trumpet, this correlator of two O's we know from the disk. It's just the two-point function in the energy basis, which we know on the disk. And it, of course, by construction, the disk correlators are given by gamma functions, by the product of gamma functions. And it correctly reproduces this first piece where you have correct factors of these gamma functions. So this computation works well, almost real, but not quite though. Yeah, it's still knows something. So a less trivial computation, a winding one. So here now we really need to start summing over diagrams on the double trumpet, or over two diagrams on the double trumpet, and then compute them using our knowledge of disk correlators. Right. So here, what are the two diagrams that we need to include in order to reproduce winding one? So here, so this horizontal line in on this picture is the line connecting these two operators on the left and on the right. But then we think about adding some loop contributions from the matrix model, right? Where you can have, where we include only diagrams such that when you go from left to right, you cross only one bare propagator. And that's a matrix model analog of saying that it's winding one, that you need to cross only one line. But then we can include also a bunch of 1PI graphs and also disconnected amputated four-point function in the middle that connects these two guys, right? And then to make it really a double trumpet computation, we need to glue top and the bottom so that it's kind of living on the cylinder. You can think about this two diagram in a geometric way, that it's living on the cylinder, and then we glue the top and the bottom on the other side, right? And we need to sum over all such insertions of 1PI of 1PI diagrams. However, there's a small, but on the other hand, not too small, and very important subtlety. That imagine, so first, before we do the gluing of the top and the bottom, right? So imagine, so this you can roughly think of as computing a four-point function, right? There's one, two, three, and four operators. But if you do this computation on the disk, then you include these 1PI graphs, like any number of these 1PI insertions on the top and on the bottom, right? Those are separately counted, right? That's on the disk. However, if you are on the trumpet, on the double trumpet, then you need to include these 1PI graphs only in one side, on one side, because you glue them on the other side. Because if you included them on both sides and then glued, it would be like gluing with a factor of two propagators. But what you really want to do to get a double trumpet is to glue them with one propagator on the other end. So again, on the disk, if you did this computation on the disk for this four-point function, there would be two factors of propagators here and here. But to do the double trumpet, you need to remove one of them and then glue, so that you glue only with one. And then if you do that, and then you can use as an input the disk correlators to, because you need this exact two-point function now, that is the summation of these 1PI graphs, and this connected amputated four-point function from the disk again, then you reproduce the correct answer. And from the disk, we know that the amputated four-point function is given by this 6J symbol, and then one of the propagators is given by this gammas, and so I'm not giving you the details, but gammas also work out correctly. And so here, it wasn't actually too hard to remove one factor of the propagator on one side to sort of translate disk correlators into double trumpet correlators. But this becomes much more non-trivial when you compute higher windings. In particular, for example, for winding two, you would have to count diagrams where you have to cross two lines when you go from left to the right. That's a sort of matrix model analog of saying that it's winding two. And then we can also include a bunch of 2PI graphs. And then again, there's a similar issue that you can, on the disk, you can include these 2PI graphs on the top and on the bottom, but to go to the double trumpet, you need to remove one string of such diagrams on one side. So for example, we remove all of them on top and leave them on the bottom and glue. So this becomes less trivial for higher windings. And this really uses the knowledge that we are working in the matrix model and we use the disk correlators. So there are some subtleties with this computation that we actually do not fully understand yet, that this computation, it turns out it depends on certain regularization. Let me not, I guess, get into that right now. But in the end, with proper choice, the answer you get is a sum of sort of two chord diagrams, which is here. And here by trace, I mean that you need to identify the top with the bottom. That is glue them on two sides. And this is a chord diagram where I think of each crossing as writing a 6J symbol and then gluing with proper Schwarz and sort of density of states and integrating. And the answer is that you get this symmetrized sum, that you get this sum of two terms where you symmetrize over these two lines, over exchange of these two lines. And this answer, in fact, turns out to be the same as the one you get from Selberg trace formula. And this is, well, this is some non-trivial identity satisfied by the 6J symbol called pentagon identity, that you can essentially expand these 6J symbols into some other objects, something related to Wilson polynomials, which are these three-point vertices, and also 6J symbols, which are still these four-point vertices. These expansions are kind of like conformal block expansions, which are dressed by the Schwarz, like conformal block expansion of GFF dressed with the Schwarz mode and so on. But in the end, you get the correct answer that you just sum over these contributions of double trace operators. And so we reproduce this answer in JT gravity, which was obtained in a completely different way using this Selberg trace formula on Riemann surfaces and so on. Higher windings, they work pretty similarly, that in the end you get this, instead of two lines here, you would have three lines, four lines, and so on, and you get a symmetrized sum over them. And then using some identities for 6J symbols, and some polynomials, you can see that you reproduce Selberg trace formula. So that's essentially it. And so to just summarize, so we described a generalization of such Anker-Stanford model to include a matter bulk field, just a free scalar, and we described it as a generalized eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, as a two matrix model of two random operators. And two diagrams of O, they had this nice geometric picture that you can think of these two diagrams as a particle propagating on the Riemann surface. It had some interesting integral structure related to the 6J symbols. There are a bunch of questions that one might think about. I'll just stop here and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. Are there any questions for Paul?
Hey, thanks for the super nice talk. I guess I was curious about interactions. Now you put on your last slide. So, I guess first, have you thought about this? And second, I mean, somehow the thing that I worked seemed to depend very much on like the special properties of the 6J symbols in the generalized case. So Does that mean that anyhow only like very special interactions would be possible, or?
Yeah. So I think you can include the interactions, but you can do that perturbatively. So the idea is that there's this free scalar limit where we have some integrable matrix model, and then you can include perturbations and do perturbation theory in the usual way. It would still using this matrix model, right? It's like we do in QFT. We know how to solve exactly free theory, and then we do perturbation theory. Here, sort of in a similar way, just instead of free theory, we have an integrable theory, and then we can do perturbations on top of that. At least conceptually, I do not see sort of any difficulties.
Okay. No. Yeah. Okay. I see. Yeah. Thanks.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank Bauer again. Thank you.